From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The decision by Mr. Trump will increase the suicide attacks, as well as attacks in the provinces, districts, and on civilians. So we are concerned about this and hope it's not going to happen.
Afghans are fearing a new wave of violence after President Trump called off a secret Camp David summit with the Taliban and the president of Afghanistan in an attempt to end the 18-year war, the longest in U.S. history. We'll go to Kabul for response, then to the Bahamas.
There are parts of Abaco and the Bahamas that don't show a great deal of damage. And then there are clusters and communities that were devastated, almost as though nuclear bombs were dropped on them. That's how great the suffering is and the devastation is.
As the death toll from Hurricane Dorian continues to rise in the Bahamas, we look at how major TV networks ignore the connection between the deadly storm and climate change. According to one count, broadcast news covered Dorian 216 times, mentioning climate change just once. Plus, we go to Tennessee, where an undocumented immigrant was shot last week by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent during a traffic stop. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump announced on Twitter Saturday he was calling off a secret meeting between himself, the Afghan president, and Taliban leaders that may have led to the withdrawal of thousands of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, although reports raise questions about the meeting's details and who exactly was going to take part. Trump said his decision was due to a Taliban car bomb last Thursday that killed 12 people in Kabul, including a U.S. soldier. Trump also said all further negotiations are being called off. The U.S. and Taliban had appeared close to an agreement after holding 9 rounds of talks in Doha, even though the Afghan government had not taken part in those meetings. The New York Times reports Trump wanted the deal to be announced at the Camp David meeting so he would be perceived as the dealmaker who pulled the peace deal together. But according to the New York Times, Taliban negotiators had agreed to come to the United States only after a deal was announced and only to meet with the American side. There are also questions about why Trump canceled the secret meeting. We'll have more on this story after headlines. At least 44 people are confirmed dead, and the number is expected to soar exponentially as the Bahamas continues to reel from the devastation wrought by Hurricane Dorian. More than 70,000 people on Grand Bahama and the Abaco Islands have been left homeless, and thousands remain missing. On Saturday, a cruise ship brought more than 1,500 Bahamians to a port in Florida. But Sunday, more than 100 people seeking aid and refuge in the United States were turned away after boarding a ferry bound for Florida. Before the boat left the Bahamas, passengers were told to disembark if they didn't have visas to enter the United States. This is Renard Oliver, a father who was forced to take his young children off the boat after the announcement.
At the last minute like this, you know, it's kind of disappointing. It's hurtful because I'm watching my daughters cry, but yeah, it is what it is.
In Tennessee, the FBI is investigating the shooting of an undocumented immigrant by an ICE agent, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, during a traffic stop last week. The shooting occurred Thursday at a supermarket parking lot in Antioch after ICE agents attempted to detain an unnamed 39-year-old Mexican man. The man reportedly attempted to flee in a white truck when one of the agents shot him twice. A local news channel has released a closed-circuit video of the incident, showing the truck driving away from the scene and one agent raising his firearm and pointing at the truck. The injured man managed to flee the scene but later surrendered to FBI agents and was treated and released from a local hospital. He's not been arrested or charged with a crime. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. HuffPost reports the Trump administration's failing to provide legal aid for locked-up migrant children in at least 3 separate jails, a violation of federal law. Without the required legal services, migrant children are forced to navigate complicated legal proceedings alone and are more likely to be deported to potentially life-threatening situations. Reyes's executive director Jonathan Ryan told HuffPost, quote, "Our government is engaged in premeditated, deliberate acts of cruelty against children. I don't think one has to be a conspiracy theorist to believe that the government is attempting to systematically dismantle every framework of support for any immigrant in the country," he said. Meanwhile, details from a lawsuit filed last month challenging the Trump administration over its termination of the Flores Agreement has highlighted the dire conditions faced by locked-up migrant children. Among the many violations, migrant girls reported being denied sufficient menstrual products and having to keep wearing soiled clothing throughout their periods. In more immigrant rights news, the Associated Press reports an 8.5-month pregnant woman from El Salvador was sent back to Mexico by immigration authorities, even after being treated in a U.S. hospital after experiencing contractions. She's one of over 38,000 asylum seekers forced out of the U.S. as part of the highly contested Remain in Mexico policy. Immigration and medical experts say pregnant migrants in Mexico often do not have access to medical care or even sufficient food and clean water. At least six pregnant migrants have been sent back to Mexico by U.S. authorities, according to Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, who's demanding an investigation into the issue. The U.S. Air Force has ordered a review of how international stopovers are chosen following a recent report by Politico pointing to possible emoluments violations linked to military spending and President Trump's Turnberry Resort in Scotland. Politico reported Friday that the House Oversight Committee has been investigating why millions of dollars were spent refueling U.S. military planes at Prestwick Airport near Trump's golf resort in Scotland. Military planes typically refuel at U.S. bases where the price of gas would be cheaper than a commercial airport. U.S. military members have also stayed at the Trump Resort and were offered free rounds of golf at Turnberry, according to an earlier report by The Guardian. New York City Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted in response to the news, quote, "The president is corrupt and must be impeached," she said. Meanwhile, as members of Congress return to the Capitol this week after their summer recess, the House Judiciary Committee is expected to vote Wednesday on a resolution to establish guidelines for impeachment proceedings against President Trump. In climate news, scientists say a massive area of the northeastern Pacific Ocean is 5 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than average in a warming event rivaling the so-called blob of 2014. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, warns it's the second worst marine heat wave observed since the agency first began collecting satellite data in 1981. The warm waters threaten to spawn a massive algae bloom and could decimate fish populations, threatening sea lions and endangered orcas and humpback whales. In Gaza, Palestinians mourn the deaths of two Palestinian teenagers shot and killed Friday by Israeli forces during weekly protests along the separation barrier with Israel. At least 70 protesters were wounded, more than half of those by Israeli gunfire, according to Gaza health officials. Palestinians have now been demonstrating for 18 months in Gaza under the banner of the Great March of Return, calling for the right to return and an end to Israel's blockade on the besieged territory. In El Salvador, 21-year-old rape survivor Evelyn Hernandez, who was acquitted last month on aggravated homicide charges for having a stillborn birth in 2016, is poised to face a third trial. Hernandez had been sentenced to 30 years in prison in 2017, but that conviction was annulled in August. Salvadoran prosecutors announced last week they'll appeal Hernandez's acquittal. Abortion is illegal in El Salvador. Russia and Ukraine swapped dozens of prisoners Saturday, a move that many are hailing as a major step towards easing tensions between the two nations following Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea. This is the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky.
We have agreed on the first stage of unblocking of our dialogue and on the first step in ending the war, the return of our prisoners of war, our soldiers, our sailors, and our territories.
Ukrainian filmmaker Oleg Sentsov was one of those freed in the exchange. Amnesty International said in a statement, quote, "Oleg Sentsov and many other jailed following Russia's occupation and illegal annexation of Crimea are simply victims of politically motivated prosecution, and they should never have been imprisoned in the first place. While it's a relief they're now free, it's a travesty to see them being used as human bargaining chips in political deals," Amnesty said. In more news from Russia, pro-Kremlin candidates retained their majority in Sunday's local elections, but suffered notable losses following weeks of political unrest. The ruling United Russia Party, which backs President Vladimir Putin, lost around a third of its seats in the Moscow legislature. Protesters have been taking to the streets over the summer after opposition candidates in Moscow's city council elections were barred from running. Police arrested thousands of people, including political candidates and opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Navalny urged supporters to vote strategically in the elections to limit the Kremlin's power. Colombia's human rights ombudsman says more than half the country is at risk of violence related to the upcoming local elections. The warning comes after the death of mayoral candidate Karina Garcia, who was brutally murdered along with at least four others while campaigning earlier this month in the Cauca region. Meanwhile, two more indigenous activists have been killed in recent days. Glably Gomez and Aida Troches, both victims, advocated for indigenous women's rights in the Cauca region. Back in the United States, former South Carolina governor and Congressmember Mark Sanford has entered the Republican 2020 primary race. He made the announcement Sunday on Fox News ahead of a formal launch later this week. "As a Republican Party, we have lost our way," he told Fox News host Chris Wallace. Sanford has highlighted government spending and federal debt as key issues. Sanford's a Trump critic who lost his congressional seat in 2018 after being defeated by a pro-Trump challenger in the primaries. Democrat Joe Cunningham eventually won the seat. Sanford is the third Republican to challenge Trump for the 2020 presidential nomination, joining former Massachusetts Governor William Weld and former Illinois Congressmember Joe Walsh. Sanford, however, will not be able to run in a primary in his own state, since the South Carolina Republican Party voted to skip the presidential primary next year to save money and throw the state's support behind the Trump campaign. President Trump is set to appoint another judge to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. One of the court's judges said last week he'll take senior status, meaning Trump can appoint a new judge to succeed him. Last month, another judge also announced he'll also become a senior judge. In total, Trump will have appointed five of the 12 judges on the court, which covers Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, and hears many civil rights cases, as well as death penalty and voting rights cases. Since Trump came into office, he's appointed nearly one out of the four of the nation's federal appeals court judges. 70% of those are white men. Two more black transgender lives were claimed over the past week, bringing the total reported number of transgender murders in the U.S. to at least 18 so far this year. In South Florida, the body of 23-year-old B. Love Slater was identified last week after being burned beyond recognition. Her friends told media she'd been threatened on Facebook and targeted because she's transgender. Meanwhile, in Baltimore, 17-year-old Bailey Reeves was fatally shot last Monday. At a vigil organized in her honor, Aya Damons of the transgender rights nonprofit Baltimore Safe Haven called out the cycle of violence against trans women, adding the first step to fighting violence is unity. And in media news, the progressive news site Think Progress shut down Friday after it failed to secure funding. Think Progress was created in 2005 as a project of the Center for American Progress Democratic Party Action Fund, but was editorially independent. Journalist Zach Carter said in a tweet, quote, "The collapse of Think Progress demonstrates the Democratic Party establishment and its donor base have little to no interest in sustaining center-left media outlets, even in the age of Trump. The election of Donald Trump and the rise of an American authoritarian movement seem not to have changed many minds among wealthy Democrats," he said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Afghanistan. This weekend, President Trump publicly called off a secret meeting at Camp David with the Taliban and the president of Afghanistan that aimed to end the 18-year war, the longest in U.S. history. Trump tweeted on Saturday, quote, "I immediately canceled the meeting and called off peace negotiations. What kind of people would kill so many in order to seemingly strengthen their bargaining position? They didn't. They only made it worse. If they cannot agree to a ceasefire during these very important peace talks and would even kill 12 innocent people, then they probably don't have the power to negotiate a meaningful agreement anyway. How many more decades are they willing to fight?" Trump asked. The United States and Taliban had appeared close to signing an agreement after holding nine rounds of talks in Doha. But the negotiations took a surprise turn when President Trump suggested a Camp David meeting that included Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, who had not been involved in the previous talks because the Taliban refused to meet with him. The New York Times reports Trump wanted the deal to be announced at Camp David so he would be perceived as the dealmaker who pulled the peace agreement together. But according to the Times, Taliban negotiators had agreed to come to the United States only after a deal was announced and only to meet with the American side. The New York Times reports, quote, Trump may have canceled a meeting that the key participants were not planning to attend, unquote. There are also questions about the premise behind why the United States canceled the secret meeting. Trump blamed it on the recent killing of a U.S. soldier in Afghanistan, but he made no reference to the mass killings being carried out by U.S. forces. On Sunday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo acknowledged the United States had killed more than 1,000 members of the Taliban in the past 10 days, just as the two sides were close to signing a peace deal.
There have been attacks during the talks, attacks from the Taliban and Americans, and enormous attacks from American forces, putting in real pressure on the Taliban. George, we've, in just the last 10 days alone, killed over 1,000 Taliban. We have been fighting and talking in a way that America often doesn't do. It's what's driven us to be able to have the success at the negotiating table.
Well, for more, we go to Kabul, Afghanistan, where we're joined by Ali Latifi, a freelance journalist. And in Washington, D.C., we're joined by Matthew Ho, a senior fellow with the Center for International Policy. In 2009, Matthew Ho resigned from the State Department in protest against the Obama administration's escalation of the war in Afghanistan. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Matthew Ho, let's begin with you. What do you understand was going to happen at Camp David, and then what President Trump called off? In fact, most people only learned there was going to be a, quote, secret meeting when President Trump tweeted that it had been called off.
Oh, good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me on. It's difficult to wrap your head around what's happening, that this is the reality of U.S. politics and then its effect on the Afghan war. And it should be noted that the Afghan war for the Afghans isn't 18 years old. It's more than 40 years old. It begins in 1973 when the king was deposed, the same year I was born. So if I was an Afghan my whole life, I would know nothing but war or at best political conflict. So what you have now is you have the situation where it appeared that the peace talks, the peace agreement, the deal to bring U.S. forces out of Afghanistan in exchange for some limited ceasefire within the country, was predicated on Donald Trump's desire to live up to his campaign promise to end the war and to show that he's a better commander-in-chief, a better war maker than, say, Bush and Obama. But the reality is this is the most malleable president the United States has ever known. And because of what he's seen on Fox News or what he's read on Twitter, he now cancels these talks. He now cancels the agreement because he's upset, because people are saying he's weak. And so for me, the whole idea of the showmanship of having it at Camp David and everything else, that's secondary to what's happening to the Afghan people. And what we're going to see now, because of a temper tantrum by the president, over what he was, what some Fox News talking heads said, or what some retired generals said, or what he read on Twitter, the Afghan people go back to basically the beginning process again, possibly, of some type of peace deal. And it's been more than 40 years of suffering for them.
Ali Latifi, what is the understanding in Kabul, Afghanistan, about what was going to take place?
Because these negotiations haven't been about the Afghan people. They've been very much about the United States and the Taliban and both of them getting what they want. And all of these meetings, these nine rounds of talks, have taken place behind closed doors in Doha. So the average person in Afghanistan has no idea. I myself am a journalist. I have very little idea. The only thing I know is the night before I had heard from different sources that Trump was planning to make his announcement on 9/11, which is ironic, I suppose, but for him, he's a showman, and so he wanted to put on a show, and he would have been able to do that. But the reality is, the Afghan people have never been a part of this process.
Can you explain what happened in Kabul last week, the suicide car bombing that killed 12 people, including a U.S. soldier?
Right. So the car bombing took place on the road that would lead to the entrance of where eventually you could get to the U.S. embassy, to NATO forces, and to different other sort of political and high-level buildings hidden behind massive blast walls. But that actual explosion didn't turn. You would have to turn right to go on that road. It went straight just a little bit forward, so it was on a highly, completely civilian road. Of course, you know, there are always U.S. soldiers and forces going back and forth along that road, and unfortunately throughout all the roads of Kabul at any given time of the day. But what ends up happening is, yes, this U.S. soldier got killed, but in reality, at least 11 Afghan civilians were killed and dozens more were injured. And this is what keeps happening. So when Trump says that, you know, this quote-unquote great, great soldier is why he called off this talk, it kind of points to what Matthew was saying, that he must have been influenced by somebody, because this is not the first time in the last couple months that U.S. soldiers have been killed, and it's not the first time in the 9 rounds of talks that U.S. soldiers have either been killed or targeted by Taliban in their attacks.
On Sunday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo acknowledged the United States had killed 1,000 Taliban in the last 10 days, just as the two sides were signing a peace deal. Ali Latifi, is this your understanding?
This is what he says. The thing we have to remember is that, I mean, I've been seeing these reports since at least 2011 from the Afghan government, and now apparently from the U.S. government, every day saying we killed 60 Talibs, or we killed 50 Talibs, or we killed 10 Talibs, or we killed militants, or we killed Daesh. And those are very hard facts to prove. Those are very difficult things to prove, because these operations take place usually at night. They take place in remote areas. They take place in areas where the press and rights workers usually don't have access, where the government doesn't generally go to follow up on these things. So it's very difficult. He can say that he killed 1,000 Taliban, but what does that really mean? Who were they? And even if they were Taliban, 1,000 Taliban, the province of Kunduz nearly fell, what was it, about 2 weeks ago, again for the third time. And then the province of Farah in the west also came under heavy attack. Next door to Kunduz, Baghlan came under heavy attack. So if you're killing 1,000 Taliban, what does that really say, if you are indeed killing 1,000 Taliban?
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. We're talking to Ali Latifi in Kabul, Afghanistan. We're talking to Matthew Ho at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. And we'll be joined by two peace activists, an American and an Afghan leader, Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, as well as Dr. Hakeem Young, a medical humanitarian worker who's worked in Afghanistan for more than 14 years. Stay with us.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you. Though I know that evening's empire has returned into sand, vanished from my hand, left me blindly here to stand, but still not sleeping. My weariness amazes me, I am branded on my feet. I have no one to meet, and the ancient empty streets too dead for dreaming. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm
Mr.
going
Tambourine
to.
Man by Bob Dylan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our coverage of Afghanistan, we're joined by two more guests in Kabul. Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, Campaign to End U.S. Military and Economic Warfare, and Dr. Hakeem Young, medical humanitarian worker who's worked in Afghanistan for more than 14 years. Kathy Kelly, we first learned of the news of a, quote, secret, as President Trump described it, Camp David meeting that would be the leaders of the Taliban, the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, and President Trump, though all of this is being called into question right now, whether the all of these people were going to be at Camp David, but now Trump has called it off. Your thoughts as both Democrats, a number of Democrats, join with Republicans in condemning the meeting, saying that it is an outrage that it's happening at all, let alone the week of 9/11, the anniversary of the September 11th attacks.
Well, Amy, I think that the outrage that should be felt ought most appropriately be outrage over the idea that warlords, multiple warlords, including the United States military authorities and anybody representing the U.S. government, have been negotiating a peace deal. And it's a charade. I mean, we've seen how many people have been killed as leverage, killing human beings has been leveraged during these peace talks, and I highly doubt that the majority of Afghanistan's people, who are women and children, are being well represented in the so-called dialogue.
Can you explain what you understand, Kathy Kelly, these peace talks have been about that have taken place in Doha?
Well, they're highly secretive, but it does seem that Zalmay Khalilzad has already dropped two of the demands that the United States was going to make, which had something to do with the Afghan government. Again, I want to say that these are warlords that we're talking about, both within the Taliban and the many groups that comprise the Taliban and the Afghan government. But the Afghan government clearly won't be included in the deal that they were talking about making. I think a ceasefire is something that is even further on down the line, should it even be called for.
And Dr. Hakeem Young, your response, working in Afghanistan for the past 14 years, to this news that has taken place. First, we learned that there was going to be a secret meeting, then that Trump was calling it off. What the explanation that also Ashraf Ghani was going to be there, considering that he has not been a part of the peace talks because the Taliban refused to negotiate with him.
Thank you, Amy, for having me. Like Greta Thunberg had said regarding the climate crisis we have in the world, in the past 14 years, I've seen how this crisis in Afghanistan, in the war, means that there is, seems to show that there's no current political system anywhere that can really hold genuine peace negotiations. I mean, these current peace negotiations, to me, are not genuine peace negotiations because Afghans are not involved. The warring parties are all equally complicit in the killing. They want to fight and talk at the same time, which doesn't work. And the Taliban in Doha are not representative of either the Afghan people or even of the Taliban.
Ali Latifi in Kabul as well. Can you explain what the points were in these negotiations and also the significance of the Afghan government, the president, Ashraf Ghani, not being included in these negotiations?
Well, I think the significance of President Ghani not being included is it's great. It's huge because at the end of the day, you know, he is the representation of the Afghan people on a political sense. He is the president of the country. I remember in an interview earlier this year, he said of Zalmay Khalilzad, who grew up with him in Kabul, who went to Beirut with him to study. You know, he said, Dr. Khalilzad is an American, and I'm the president of 32 million Afghan people. And yet he's not included, but Zalmay Khalilzad, who worked for Bush, you know, who was his ambassador to Afghanistan and to Iraq during the occupation of Iraq, is there. And then the only Afghans present are the Taliban. So this is a big, huge deal. As to what's being negotiated, we keep hearing 2 points. 2 points that only serve the interests of Washington and the Taliban. Washington's interest is this claim that the Taliban can no longer house or support quote-unquote foreign terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda. which it hasn't been able to do in 18 years, which it won't be able to do, and which it genuinely has no interest in, as far as you can tell. I mean, even when they claim to target U.S. soldiers and U.S. forces, what ends up happening is that it's the Afghan people who continue to die. They're saying they're fighting an occupation, but they're continuing to kill our own people. And then for the Taliban, they're getting what they want in the sense that the U.S. is going to agree to some kind of a troop pullout. And that's really all we know. Everything else is done behind closed doors. Everything else is secretive. We know that the president got a copy of the agreement in principle signed between Khalilzad and the Taliban, which had to be approved by Trump. And he had questions about the wording and about the specifics. We know that his chief executive got a copy of it. But other than that, the average Afghan has no idea what would have been in that any sort of document or agreement.
Matthew Ho in Washington, D.C., you worked in the State Department in Afghanistan. 10 years ago, you resigned. You're now with the Center for International Policy. Can you talk about what you think the mistakes of the Obama and then Trump administration have been, what you understand is being negotiated, how can it be negotiated without the Afghan president to be successful? And finally now, this pile-on by Democrats as well as Republicans, outrage that any deal would be signed, or more importantly, that Taliban would step foot on U.S. soil. And again, the emphasis they're making right now, this week of September 11th, the anniversary of the attacks in 2001.
You know, I was thinking, Amy, I recall 8 years ago being here in this same exact little studio talking to you about the death of bin Laden. I think you have to go further back to understand what's happening with the United States, why the Democrats are piling on, as you said, against any type of peace deal, against any type of withdrawal of American forces. You have to go back to 1947 and the National Security Act that President Truman puts in place that creates this permanent war-making establishment within the United States government that makes the priority of the United States government war. And so I think that's what you see here when you see any semblance of a deal. And I agree with everyone in Kabul who knows certainly better than I do. I'm sitting here in D.C. drinking a cup of coffee and you know, I mean, that the United States government is not to be trusted in these issues. The United States government started funding the war in Afghanistan months before the Soviet Union invaded in 1979. They wanted to bring about the Soviets into a trap to create the Soviets their own Vietnam. When the Soviets leave in 1989, the United States government keeps funding the various Mujahideen groups, and the fighting continues. So the United States has been culpable in the violence that has beset and just besieged the Afghan people for more than four decades now. So I think that it's hard for the United States, one, to take responsibility for of it. You won't hear this kind of conversation within corporate media. You won't hear this conversation from politicians. You certainly won't hear this conversation from the retired generals who are the talking heads who are all being funded by the defense industry. And so I think for the United States, our perspective is we have to take a step back and look at the bigger picture. I mean, since 9/11, we don't even know how many places we have sent young people to kill other people and be killed themselves. The estimates are between 15 and 22 countries the United States has waged war in since 2001. So for the United States, what's happening in Afghanistan is something that we just shrug and move on with the next news cycle for, or wait for President Trump to have another temper tantrum about. But there's hardly any conversation about the Afghan people. And so just to wrap up my little piece here, the points being made in Kabul are exact and correct, that the United States has been a belligerent. The United States is not to be trusted. And what I would hope for the Afghan people in the next presidential elections, hopefully in the next month or so, that the victor in that contest proceeds without the United States, without foreign powers, and tries to find a solution for the Afghan people, because the only solution for this war is going to come from the Afghan people themselves.
Ali Latifi, before we lose you, lose the satellite in Kabul, you're a freelance journalist. What are the conditions on the ground right now? And you're in Kabul. And who are the Taliban leaders who supposedly were going to go to Camp David? And do you understand all the talks are being derailed altogether? And do people in Afghanistan even understand talks were underway and who are the parties to these talks?
Everyone knows that talks are underway. They had some who, you know, was party to these talks. Essentially, the parties still come down to the idea that it's the United States and the Taliban. And one thing we have to remember is that, in general, the feeling was that this was going to be a bad deal, that this was not a deal for the Afghan people in any way. Obviously, the way Trump went about it, the way Democrats and Republicans are arguing about it, is very detached from reality. But the reality on the ground is that most people felt like this would have been a bad deal anyways. Obviously, a deal needs to be made, but the question is always, how is a deal being made? Who is being involved and what is being discussed? And as long as these deals are being made in foreign capitals behind closed doors without, you know, I say even if the Afghan government gets involved, it's still not enough. You still need, there's 32 million people that will suffer the consequences or see the benefits of whatever agreement is made. So you still need to make sure that there are young people involved, that there are women involved, that there are different ethnicities involved, that there are different religious sects involved, that everybody has some kind of a say in these negotiations. These kinds of negotiations need to happen because it's become very clear that that this war won't be won on the battlefield. But they need to happen in a proper way, right? They need to happen correctly. Right now, there are a lot of supporters of the president and this government very happy that this deal went down in flames because it ensures that an election will happen, which they feel like they'll win. But it kind of, it hinges on this assumption that this war can be won on the battlefield, which, again, we've proven time and time again, unfortunately, is not true. A deal has to be made, but it can't be just any deal as well.
Kathy Kelly, you are a longtime peace activist on the ground. You have gone to Afghanistan countless times where you are right now. What is the understanding of peace activists on the ground? What are they calling for? And also, in the last days, the reports we had, the New York Times reporting the White House was seriously considering expanding the CIA's presence in Afghanistan if and when international forces begin to leave the country, U.S. forces. A senior White House advisor is seeking to expand the CIA's presence. The CIA presence would include the creation of new counterterrorism militia forces, but the CIA director Gina Haspel reportedly has raised concerns about the idea. The Taliban has said the CIA must also leave Afghanistan along with the military.
Well, and we might add also that since President Trump took office, there's been a 65% increase in private security contractors in Afghanistan being paid by the United States. There's a lot of skepticism on the part of young peace activists whom I know. They don't any longer expect that negotiators are going to help them have a more secure future. They tell us about others in their classes who can't possibly find jobs, and so for the sake of an income, enlist in one militia or another. And they now even begin to wonder themselves if their own fellow students will begin to urge taking up weapons. But I've been impressed by the commitment to try to solve problems without resorting to war on the part of people who are living in a war-torn area and have been deeply traumatized by events of the past year. So many of them have their own friends now only as memories. The loss of life has been staggering. So I don't think that the United States is showing much concern for people on the verge of civil war because of the possible consequences of the deal-making. You know, the United States in 2018 sent 123 million bullets to Afghanistan, and that was an eightfold rise over the number of bullets sent in 2017. And what does that say about a concern to preserve life and help people survive these times?
And finally, Dr. Hakeem Young, explain why you came to Afghanistan 14 years ago as a medical humanitarian worker, and what you think this all means. Will this derail all talks, or will it simply be that people don't come to the Taliban don't come to the United States, but the talks continue in Doha or other places?
Thank you. I came to Afghanistan for the purpose of trying to help in the medical health services. As we know, the medical humanitarian situation in Afghanistan has always been a challenging one, a crisis. With the talks, maybe I can describe it by using an analogy. We have 32 million ordinary Afghans here in this country. The United States has a population of about 320 million ordinary Americans. If the United States had a militant, religiously motivated group within the United States that are killing Americans, and the United States government asked the UK government to help them fight these militants, what the peace deals today are like would be like the UK government now inviting the militant, religiously motivated militants in the US to London to talk about making a peace deal over 320 million ordinary Americans. So it's preposterous, it's theater, it is a show. It is what Afghans say is a game. So I think that such a nature of peace deals should really be suspended for genuine peace negotiations.
We're going to leave it there for now, but of course we will continue. Were you just saying something, Kathy?
No, thanks, Amy. Thanks very much for including us.
Dr. Hakeem Young, medical humanitarian worker who's worked in Afghanistan for more than 14 years. Matthew Hohen, Washington, D.C., senior fellow for the Center for International Policy, resigned 10 years ago in protest of the Obama administration's escalation of the war in Afghanistan. Ali Latifi in Kabul, Afghanistan, freelance journalist. And Kathy Kelly, also there in the capital of Afghanistan, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, a campaign to end U.S. military and economic warfare. Coming up, as the death toll from Hurricane Dorian continues to rise in the Bahamas, we look at how major TV networks ignored the connection between the deadly storm and climate change. But first, we'll go to Tennessee, where an ICE agent shot an undocumented immigrant in a Tennessee parking lot. Stay with us.
Like little Nassau by the sea. Nassau moon in the sky so clear. So many things you're bound to hear. Like Calypso's song and lullaby. You never wanna say goodbye.
My Hometown by Ray Smith. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Tennessee, where the FBI is investigating the shooting of an undocumented immigrant by an ICE agent, that's an Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent, during a traffic stop last week. The shooting occurred Thursday at a supermarket parking lot in Antioch, a suburb of Nashville, where workers often gather to be picked up for a day's work. ICE agents were attempting to detain an unnamed 39-year-old Mexican man who reportedly attempted to flee in a white box truck when one of the agents shot him twice. A local news channel has released a surveillance video of the incident showing the white truck driving away from the scene and one agent raising his firearm and pointing at the truck. The injured man did manage to flee the scene, but later surrendered to FBI and was treated and released from a local hospital. He has not been arrested or charged with a crime. It has now been revealed the ICE agent involved in the shooting is one of the officers who made headlines in July after community members blocked attempts to detain another undocumented man in Hermitage, Tennessee. ICE agents tried to intercept the man who'd been living in the community for 14 years as he left his home with his son by blocking him into the driveway. But community members formed a human chain so that the father and son could exit the van and re-enter their home, stopping the agents. Hernan Crescencio, a member of Nashville-based immigrant rights group, The Mix, said in a statement, quote, "In light of what happened this morning, it's clear that Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials are aware and frustrated that community members understand how to exercise their rights. Now ICE agents are taking out their frustrations on our neighbors by escalating civil matters into use of lethal force," they said. For more, we go to Brenda Perez, member of The Mix, a Nashville-based community organizing and immigrant rights group. Welcome to Democracy Now! Please explain what happened last Thursday. This all started in a parking lot where workers gather for a day's work.
Yes, and thank you so much for having us on. So this happened on Thursday morning around 7 a.m. So it's a very busy intersection. You see school buses driving on that road. People are gathering to get ready for work, to do ride sharing in like a very informal situation. When ICE agents approached three men in a vehicle, two of the men provided the IDs, and the third man who was shot at did not provide his identification. He knew he didn't have to. The ICE agents were not presenting the correct paperwork. They were not presenting a warrant. And at some point, the gentleman who was shot at was like moved into a box truck, and he decided to drive off. I think it's a very intense situation, and we don't know how we will react in this manner. So he decided to drive off, and when he drove off, the agent, in the video, you can see that he was like alongside the truck, kind of followed the truck, and then extended his arm and shot at the truck. So there was, so he was injured. The man was injured. He had a bullet wound in the stomach and in his elbow. And he drove off, took refuge somewhere. We didn't know where he was. There was a lot of concern in the community for his safety and his health. Later on, through the support of his attorney and through conversations with the FBI, we were able to negotiate him surrendering himself at the local hospital and receive treatments. He received like a surgery that evening, and he was able to communicate with his children and his family. And he has not been placed under arrest, and he's not under anybody's custody right now.
Was the ICE agent arrested?
The ICE agent was not arrested that we know of.
So explain who the ICE agent is who opened fire on this truck, and explain what local Nashville police are doing. Are they cooperating with the ICE agents?
Yeah, so this ICE agent is the very same ICE agent that was in Hermitage, which is another suburb of Nashville, where they were using the local police department and stating things like, you know, if you don't come out of the truck, we're going to arrest you, as a man and his child were waiting in the van. That standoff led to 4 hours. The man who was inside the van and his son, they knew their rights. So immediately, as soon as the ICE agents approached them, they started recording. They knew they didn't have to exit. They didn't believe any of his lies, and just held off until community support arrived and was there to like send them food, to fill up their gasoline. This is the same ICE agent. This is the same ICE agent that has also been spotted at local courthouses here in Nashville. And this is the same ICE agent that was there on Thursday morning. What we're seeing is basically an agent and a whole organization that feels no accountability to the community and no accountability to public safety. I mean, when he fired those shots, that road, Richards Road, is a very busy intersection filled with a lot of immigrant communities headed to school, headed to work, headed to whatever their lights leads them to. And he fired those shots. You know, we saw a lot of comments on social media about parents whose children heard the gunshots, who were there taken to school and had to process this kind of on their own. And as the story developed, like the teachers were informed. We heard Tennessee Immigrant Rights Refugee Coalition put out a statement saying that some teachers rode back with their students on the school buses because there was such a concern and fear in the community because children didn't know what they were coming back to. And it's all because of this one ICE agent who has no accountability to anybody.
Can you talk about the fact that Nashville is home to the Davidson County Jail, a core civic facility that's one of the biggest ICE detention jails in Tennessee? Does this jail play a role in what's going on here?
Yeah. And not only are we home to a core civic facility in our Davidson County Jail, we're also home to a core civic headquarters, and they are headquartered here as well. As we know, like, Sheriff's Department didn't have anything to do with this incident. However, on a daily basis, anybody who's arrested in Nashville is held at the Davidson County Sheriff's Department jail. So Metro Police does not have a jail. It's all run through the Sheriff's Department. The Sheriff's Department, under the jurisdiction of Sheriff Darren Hall, has had a contract with ICE where people, immigration status is constantly being checked and people are being deported out of our county jail. So although we can have these local politicians saying that we are a welcoming city, that we want to be pro-immigrant, as long as we continue to have that contract in our county jail, we are not, and we will have a deportation pipeline out of our city. And we continue to have a deportation pipeline out of our city.
Finally, we're talking to you in this week of the mayoral runoff. So things are also very much coming to a boiling point on these issues, certainly being discussed in the media. You have the Nashville mayor's runoff election taking place on Thursday. Mayor David Brierley has said the shooting is exactly what we don't want happening in our city. Your thoughts on his record on immigration, as well as his opponent, Councilman John Cooper?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Mayor David Brierley recently put out a statement that the local government is going to challenge the HB 2315, which is a law that took effect this year, which allows all kind of state government employees and state law enforcement employees to act as immigration agents, and authorizes them to question people on their immigration status. It extends so far as to allowing the school resource officers to ask about immigration status, so it put a lot of fear in the community. I think that was a good step on his behalf to make this announcement. It could have been sooner. It could have obviously been sooner. I read the other candidate's statement about what happened on Thursday, and basically he was just saying, we're here for investigation. I think both of the mayors can say wonderful things about being pro-immigrant and being on our side of the story. But until somebody steps out and says that they're willing to challenge the government contract and the ICE contract at the Davidson County Jail, we're not going to have any changes in our city. We have these agents that are rogue and they have no accountability to anybody out there. And we have this deportation pipeline coming out of our jail. So until one of these mayor candidates can actually make a statement against that, then we really know what's happening.
Brenda Perez, I want to thank you for being with us, member of the MIX, a Nashville-based immigrants' rights group in Tennessee. As we end today's show with Hurricane Dorian, at least 44 people dead. The number is expected to soar dramatically as the Bahamas continues to reel from the devastation wrought by Hurricane Dorian last week. More than 70,000 on Grand Bahama and the Abaco Islands have been left homeless. Hundreds, possibly thousands, remain missing. As the Bahamas faces this unprecedented destruction, the island nation archipelago has been described as ground zero for the climate crisis. Despite this, the mainstream media has largely omitted any mention of global warming in its coverage of the disaster. A study by Public Citizen found the country's leading print publications devoted 363 articles to Dorian, but only 9 mentioned climate change. Another study by Media Matters in the first week after Dorian hit, from August 28th to September 5th, found that of the 216 segments aired on the main television networks on Dorian, only one mentioned climate change. For more, we go to Washington, D.C. to speak with Allison Fisher, Outreach Director of Public Citizens Climate and Energy Program. Allison, thanks so much for being with us. You have the broadcast networks, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS, and you have the cable networks, you know, not only talking about Fox, but talking about CNN and MSNBC as well. Nonstop coverage, the lead up to Dorian, and of course, the crisis of what happened in the Bahamas. Almost never a mention of climate change. Talk about this.
Yeah, that's right. So we actually looked at 4 days of coverage, and that included the lead up to the storm making landfall in the Bahamas. And what we found was the major TV news programs and the major papers across the country, with few exception, connected the intensity of the storm with our increasingly warming climate. So specifically, just to give you some of those numbers to see how few we're talking about, just 7% of the TV networks made the link between climate change and this particular hurricane. And even less in the newspapers, just 8 of the papers that that covered that did Dorian coverage made that link. So, you know, if you are an American that is turning to one of these sources, whether it be ABC or NBC or your major paper in your state for information, you are not hearing what the scientific community wants you to know, which is the climate crisis is making these storms much more dangerous and in some cases deadly. And Amy, unfortunately, this is not an isolated incident. We can very easily substitute Dorian for Hurricane Michael or Harvey or Florence or even unprecedented wildfires, 500-year storms, record-breaking heat waves, and we would be having the same conversation and making the same critique, which is when climate-fueled extreme weather events happen, by and large, the media is not talking about climate, and it's precisely the moment when they should be.
How often do they have climate scientists on, Allison?
Very rarely. We've looked at all of the extreme events that have happened in the last couple of years, and very rarely are they bringing people into the studio to communicate the science. And this is very problematic. The papers are doing a little bit better with quoting the most up-to-date science and scientists, but the TV networks are not bringing in communicators. And what's very problematic, and possibly the reason why they're not making the connection, is because they're not familiar with the science. So you have, you have them shy about making the connection, hesitant to make the connection, and then failing to bring in people that can actually communicate and have the credibility to talk to the American people about this issue. So it's a problem all the way around.
Interestingly, Chad Myers, a CNN meteorologist, who if people watch CNN, they see him on all the time, and of course the meteorologists are constantly on during this storm coverage. He just recently wrote a piece, "I am a CNN meteorologist. I used to be a climate crisis skeptic." And he talked about how he's transforming, although it's not reflected as much, I must say, on the network, which, I mean, the meteorologists in Europe, when we covered the UN climate summit, there are groups of meteorologists who are demanding that their fellow and sister meteorologists start raising the issue of climate crisis that they do in their coverage. You had Heidi Cullen, who is at the Weather Channel, who, when she raised this issue, was basically forced out.
Yeah, there's been a number of reports that have come out about the relationship between the American people and their meteorologist, the person that tells them about the weather. And they're one of the most trusted sources on TV. And so it's extremely important that they're the ones that are communicating the dangers of climate change and giving context to these extreme weather events to let people know that that's exactly what we're experiencing. There's certainly some fear out there that having this conversation and the meteorologists having this conversation with their audiences is polarizing and can be seen as politicizing the issue. And it's really not. It's really the exact moment to not be talking about the politics, but be talking about the science and normalize that and have that be a bigger part of the conversation.
Can you talk specifically about how the President Trump denying climate change has had an effect on media coverage, even though you have the networks outside of the network that he considers his home, Fox, so he's been critical of it lately, CNN, MSNBC, critical of him in so many other ways, again, rarely raising the issue of the climate crisis in their their regular meteorological coverage, weather coverage.
Yeah, by and large, the media is not holding President Trump accountable for his climate denial or for his inaction, for that matter. Mostly, what happens is when he makes a comment about these events, the story becomes about him, and it becomes about the thing that he said. And again, it deflects away from the conversation that the media, whether it be the network news or the local papers or the Bader papers,
they spend much more time talking about his magic marker and falsely saying Alabama would be hit than about the critical issue of climate crisis. Allison Fisher of Public Citizen, thanks so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.